Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to our half-hour English feature program. I'm Susie Hodges. Coming up on today's program, Papal Audience. Pope Benedict focuses on the figure of the 7th century monk and preacher St. Maximus the Confessor in his catechesis at the General Audience. Spotlight on Paul. In the run-up to this week's opening of the Pauline year to mark the bimillennium of the Apostle's birth, we take a closer look at St. Paul's life and work with one of the world's leading Pauline scholars. Hungry Americans. We find out how the global food price crisis is not just impacting on the poor in developing nations, but even on people in the richest county of the world's richest nation. At his general audience today, Pope Benedict spoke about the figure of the 7th century monk and preacher St. Maximus the Confessor. Lydia Kane tells us more.
On a scorching Wednesday in Rome, Pope Benedict arrived into St. Peter's Square wearing a red, wide-brimmed Saturno hat to protect him from the heat of the sun. After warmly greeting the crowds gathered, the Holy Father chose another early saint of the Church to speak on this week. The saint in question was St. Maximus the Confessor.
Dear brothers and sisters, in today's catechesis we turn to St. Maximus the Confessor, a heroic defender of the Church's faith in the true humanity of Christ amidst the bitter theological controversies of the 7th century. Born in Palestine, Maximus became a monk and lived in Constantinople, Roman Africa, and Rome itself. In his preaching and writings, he defended the mystery of the Incarnation and opposed the monothelite heresy, which refused to acknowledge the presence of an integral human will in Jesus Christ.
The Pope went on to talk about God's saving plan for us and how it inspired the theology of this saint.
Maximus clearly understood that our salvation depends on Christ's complete humanity, which necessarily includes a human will capable of freely cooperating with the divine will, in achieving the work of our redemption. The salvation of man, and indeed the entire cosmos, is central to the theology of St. Maximus. Through the incarnation of the Son of God, the whole universe is now redeemed and unified. Christ is thus the one absolute value to whom all worldly values are directed. This vision of a cosmic liturgy centered on the incarnate Lord ought to inspire the efforts of Christians today to make our world conform ever more fully to its ultimate meaning and goal in God's saving plan.
While speaking in Italian, the Pope said the courage of St. Maximus was an important value, just like tolerance, freedom, and dialogue are values that today are justly defended. But he said they must be seen in relation to the person of Christ in order to have significance. Earlier in the morning, Pope Benedict had blessed a new statue of St. Luigi Orione in a niche outside the Vatican Basilica. The ceremony was the culmination of initiatives that the monks of his order, the Little Works of Divine Providence, have promoted since St. Luigi's canonization on May 16, 2004. In a final greeting in English, the Pope had a special welcome for the pilgrims from the International Foundation for the Service of Deaf Persons.
Dear brothers and sisters, I offer a warm welcome together with the assurance of my closeness in prayer to the group of pilgrims from the International Foundation for the Service of Deaf Persons, upon all the English-speaking pilgrims, especially those from England, Scotland, the Netherlands, Iceland, Sweden, Pakistan, and the United States of America, I cordially invoke God's blessings of joy and peace.
I'm Lydia O'Kane.
This weekend marks the official inauguration of the Pauline year, dedicated to the Apostle St. Paul to mark the 2000th anniversary of his birth. Pope Benedict will officially usher in the Pauline year at First Vespers in the Roman Basilica of St. Paul's outside the walls, on the eve of the solemnity of Saints Peter and Paul. Underlining the ecumenical nature of the commemoration, the ceremony will be attended by the Ecumenical Patriarch of Constantinople, Bartholomew I, and by high-ranking representatives of other Christian denominations and communities. At the Vespers, the first door on the left of the Basilica, which is normally always kept closed, will be ceremonially opened and declared the Pauline door. Vatican Radio will broadcast live commentary in English of the Vespers beginning at 6 p.m. Rome time on Saturday, and also of the Mass at 9:30 a.m. on Sunday morning in St. Peter's Basilica, during which the Pope will confer the pallia on the new Metropolitan Archbishops. Born Saul of Tarsus, St. Paul became one of the Church's foremost evangelizers after his dramatic conversion on the road to Damascus. And his letters are a primary source of information about the life of the early Christian Church. Paul's influence on Christian thinking, arguably, has been more significant than any other New Testament author. Well, to find out more about St. Paul's life and work, his personality, and his continuing relevance today, I turn to Dominican Father Jerome Murphy O'Connor, who's a New Testament professor at the École Biblique in Jerusalem. He's one of the world's most renowned scholars on the letters of St. Paul and the author of around half a dozen books on the Apostle's life and work. Father Jerome began by telling me what he sees as the main significance of this upcoming Pauline year.
The significance of the Pauline year will be to draw attention to the theologian of the New Testament, who is, in my view, the most relevant to the 21st century. That I understand his analysis of the world he had to change, the society that he had to convert, that is so accurate and so descriptive of our society that I feel very strongly that the solutions that he devised and which worked for him, that if we gave them a chance, they should work for us.
You said there that you feel that St. Paul is the most relevant to our modern age. Why is that?
Well, he sees society as characterized above all by divisions. On the macro level, nation against nation, different levels of society, and then individuals are separated from others by barriers of fear and hostility. And to me, that's a very accurate description of our world. And so that's what led Paul then to create the community that we call the Church. He wasn't interested in saving individuals. Individuals were saved only as members of a body.
What great figures in the Church in the centuries that followed did he have most influence on?
The tragedy of Paul is that we have his letters and they were very influential. But once his personality disappeared, then the idealism of his community faded. Like the Pauline communities are extremely idealistic, whereas Matthew's community, for example, is a management community. There's a little bit for everyone and no cohesive vision. And Paul was simply, I think, a little too strong. Remember, Paul is criticized in one of the letters of St. Peter.
And in fact, St. Paul did fall out with people, didn't he? Like Barnabas, the disciple. What kind of personality did he have? Was he, shall we say, very uncompromising?
I think Paul was uncompromising. He also was extremely thin-skinned and tended to identify what he would consider insults to himself as insults to the gospel. He really identified so completely with his mission that he would have been extremely difficult to live with.
What we know about St. Paul comes from the Acts of the Apostles and his letters in the New Testament, yet there are inconsistencies and even contradictions between what he says in one and in the other. And, of course, there is the fact that his authorship of several of these epistles is in doubt. Do you agree with that?
I don't fully agree with the consensus, like the vast majority of scholars would say that 2 Thessalonians and Colossians and Ephesians were not written by Paul. Well, I think the first two were. I don't think Ephesians was written by Paul. In its present shape, it contains an older and lost letter, the letter to the Laodiceans. There are serious disagreements between the Acts of the Apostles and the Pauline letters. For example, in the Acts of the Apostles, Paul is forced to leave Damascus because he is threatened by Jews, whereas for Paul himself, he has to leave Damascus because he is threatened by the Nabataeans, which is historically correct. So when studying Paul or building up an image of the life of Paul, one must give absolute priority to the letters and treat Acts of the Apostles positively but critically.
Talking of criticism, St. Paul has been accused by some of being a misogynist because of what he wrote about the role of women in certain of his letters. Is that a fair criticism in your view?
No, I think it's completely wrong to think of Paul as a misogynist, that I would think he was perhaps the greatest promoter of women's ministry in the first century.
And when it comes to his theology, what do you believe are the most striking elements there? Could you elaborate for us?
The most striking element of Paul's theology is his concept of the church as the body of Christ. Now we, because of the divisiveness of the world in which we live, we tend to think of that as talking about cooperation, coordination. For Paul, it was much more profound. It was a matter of shared existence, that the arm and the leg belong to the same thing, and that is how they exist. So for Paul, we belong to one another. As he said, without love, I do not exist. And it is that relationship of love that constitutes the very existence of the body. And he calls that is the body of Christ, by which he means that the church is the physical presence of Christ in the world. If you want to know Christ, you act within the community. You don't go off on your own and make a retreat. And furthermore, for Paul, that church, the community, the body of Christ, he calls it Christ. He uses the word Christ both of the historical Jesus and of the community. And it is only when the community is truly Christ-like that it can use the first person singular. This is my body. Paul has a very varied but very consistent and radical theology.
When you say radical, what are you thinking of there in particular?
For Paul, there can be no Eucharist if the members of the community celebrating the Eucharist do not actually love one another. This is spelled out unambiguously in 1 Corinthians chapter 11. It's radical in the sense that this is a challenge to our churches, where people, the same people, go to the same Mass every day of the week and don't even bother to learn each other's names. For Paul, there could be no Eucharist in that type of community.
Right, we've talked quite a lot about Paul and his teaching, his theology. But when it comes to his life, of course, he was first and foremost a missionary and he did a lot of travelling. He courted a lot of danger. What do you think are some of the most significant incidents in this very action-packed life that he led?
Well, he was in and out of jail on a regular basis. He was shipwrecked and he was extremely lucky in that he survived, because no ship would divert to pick up a drowning man. It would be extremely difficult, and they would be long past him by the time they could turn around. So he must have drifted on a current that brought him to one of the many islands in the Aegean, and then he was very lucky that he hit an easy beach, not the bottom of a cliff, so that he must have been terrified every time he travelled by boat. But if it was necessary to bring the gospel, then that's what he did.
He certainly didn't flinch, did he, or turn
back?
No,
he was extremely courageous. And when you think that each of his journey would be about 20,000 miles, that he must have been a very tough, fit man.
It's been pointed out that Paul's letters are full of expositions of what Christians should believe and how they should live, and not so much about the life and teachings of Jesus. Why do you believe this was so?
I think that Paul had a very detailed knowledge of the historical Jesus. Remember, he spent 2 weeks with Peter in Jerusalem shortly after his conversion, and they certainly didn't waste time talking about the weather or the illnesses of mother-in-law. And they would have talked about Jesus, and Paul refers more than 20 times to words of Jesus, and he also had a very precise knowledge of the behavior of Jesus. There were two aspects of the personality of Jesus that struck him particularly, and one was his steadfastness, his fidelity. As Paul says, our lives are yes and no. His life was an enduring yes. Now, that sort of person, single-minded, can be rather cold. But the other aspect that Paul finds very significant is that Jesus was emotional. His tenderness, his compassion, his love for people, these are factors that he mentions several times. Now, Paul did all that. He spoke about Jesus when he was with these people in their conversion visit. That's when he would have spoken about the historic of Jesus. The letters all deal with particular problems, and so that he simply refers to Jesus, his teaching, his personality, as something that they already know well.
Paul did, of course, in his time have many enemies and detractors, didn't he? Was it, as we were saying earlier, perhaps because of his somewhat abrasive character?
Well, Paul had enemies in the Jewish wing of the church. You see, there were those, led by James, for example, who believed that Gentiles should become Jews, that is, accept circumcision, in order to become Christians. Paul objected violently to that. But he nonetheless accepted Jews as members of his community. And he eventually turned completely against the law. Remember, when he arrives in Jerusalem for what he feared might be his last visit, James tells him, "You tell everyone not to obey the law of Moses or to follow the customs." So that for many Jewish Christians, Paul would have been the ultimate apostate.
And coming back to this Pauline year, do you hope that it will make people rediscover this figure of St. Paul, perhaps correct some of their misconceptions about this figure? What are you hoping will emerge during this Pauline year?
What I hope is that it will inspire people to study, to read Paul, not as individuals, but as members of a group. I don't believe that Bible groups are a pooling of ignorance. What I think happens, if it's done prayerfully, is that the biases cancel each other out, and so that one arrives at the historical truth. So I would like a group, very diverse, male, female, right-wing, left-wing, read Paul together and thrash out what they get from him. And that, I think, would be the most vital way of appreciating the extraordinary quality of the great apostle.
Finally, what do you think, if you had to single out one thing among so many, is St. Paul's most important lasting legacy today?
Paul's most last important legacy to me is his idealism. Even though he knew he never measured up to the ideal that he professed, he never watered down that ideal to make himself feel comfortable. He knew he wasn't perfect, Philippians chapter 3. But all today in our modern theology, we create a theology that makes us feel comfortable. Paul would repudiate that completely.
I was speaking there to Father Jerome Murphy O'Connor, a New Testament professor and author of several books on St. Paul. The global food price crisis and its causes and effects have been the subject of much concern and heated debate in recent months, not least at the recent UN Food Summit here in Rome. NGOs and church-based relief agencies across the globe have been expressing alarm at how the soaring price of food and fuel has been impacting on the poor and vulnerable in developing nations. UN experts warn that these massive food price increases are threatening to push an extra 100 million people into hunger. But as I've been finding out, the spectre of hunger as a result of this crisis is not just confined to the developing nations. In America, the richest nation on earth, a rising number of people are lining up for free food because they are struggling to put meals on the table at home. The upward trend in the number of people applying for free food is one sign of the US economic downturn,
in which the soaring price of fuel and many basic foodstuffs have pushed many people on low incomes into hardship. A new survey by Catholic Charities USA says amid these tough times, more and more working poor and middle-class individuals are turning to them to help make ends meet. Fairfield in Connecticut is the US's richest county. But even in this upmarket area, there are more and more residents that risk going to bed hungry at times because they can't afford to feed themselves adequately. Al Barber is president of Catholic Charities in Fairfield County, and he told me how they have recently seen a dramatic increase in the number of those seeking food assistance.
The last 6 to 9 months have been affected by a tremendous increase, as most know, in fuel prices and therefore in food costs. And that when that happens here in even the wealthiest country in the world and within the wealthiest country in the world, Fairfield County in particular, where I sit, the numbers go up significantly, and the change in the people who come to our food kitchens is dramatic. Families versus individuals is commonplace. I know that in our largest soup kitchen, 2 years ago when we last spoke, we served 265,000 meals. Last year, we served 295,000 meals. And right now, we are expecting in this year to serve 330,000 meals. And that's a pattern that exists across all of this area as people are having to make decisions between buying fuel to go to work and buying food for themselves and their families.
You mentioned about how the soaring price of fuel and how it's impacted on food prices as well. And so a lot of people are being tipped over the edge, as it were. So what kind of people are now the new poor, shall we say, as a result of this new situation?
What we're experiencing, and I often refer to it when I speak in parishes and in communities that we serve, we're experiencing economic compression. And what's happened is the working poor families who are at the level just above that at which they have been historically able to pretty much take care of themselves with a little bit of assistance, have been now pushed down into that category where they need help with many things, food being one of them. So when we open our soup kitchens every day, we see more and more of those kinds of families. I often tell our parishioners that they might have an image of our soup kitchens containing or serving only people with chronic mental illness or who are chronically homeless. And in fact, there are individuals in the audience or who could be in the audience, and you would never know the difference, that need food and that come to our soup kitchens.
Do these people feel in some ways ashamed that they have to go to a soup kitchen to get fed? They need this extra help, or are times so hard that they're not thinking about that?
I think at first they do feel ashamed. They're concerned about the environment they're going into because they really don't know much about it. Once they do join us and they see how welcome they are and how many other people there are like them and that the food is nutritious and good, and it's an opportunity in many cases to socialize, to network, they lose that shame, as you might refer to it. I think the other plus is that many of our food operations are staffed by volunteers who are aware of the problem and who treat these people with great dignity.
You live in Fairfield County, which is the most affluent county in the U.S. How much is this new poverty and hardship hidden, or is it now beginning to become quite visible?
Depends on the community that you're in. And in Bridgeport, where my office is, there is very evident poverty. There has been for quite some time, and it just is maintained. Down in Stamford, which is the Gold Coast of Fairfield County, is where we're seeing a greater impact, a greater increase in demand for services, because, in fact, there are more people being pushed into that poverty arena.
You say that many of these, shall we say, the people who have newly fallen into the hunger trap, the poverty trap, most of these, in fact, do have a job, but they just can't make ends meet now.
Most of them do. In fact, if you turn the clock back a number of years, you certainly had a percentage of this group that had a job and they couldn't make ends meet. But a much larger part of the group were people who were on welfare, who were chronically mentally ill, who really were in the safety net. Now it's a different group of people who can't make ends meet because there has been this economic shift.
I know that you yourself have sometimes donned an apron and helped serve food to the hungry at the soup kitchens. What do you and others like you learn from experiences like this? Tell us something.
I will throw in the fact that Bishop Laurie does it with me a number of times a year. And I think the difference over the course of our last few visits, and he and I often go together, is the level of concern, compassion that is raised in everyone personally who does it, the willingness to sit with a table of people who are there to get help. The bishop himself had a stunning conversation in one of our soup kitchens several months back where he said to me afterwards, you know, the gentleman I was just speaking to was saying things about the way the Lord was helping him that you would have thought I, the bishop, should be saying to those there. And he said it really touched him, and it always, you know, is touching to our volunteers.
And how would you evaluate how the church in general is helping these poor and hungry people? Would you like to see other initiatives that could be taken to sort of also alleviate the plight for these people?
Absolutely. And, you know, that was echoed by Pope Benedict when he was here. I know you realize that he was a huge hit in the New York and D.C. area. I personally was in D.C. and was able to join the group at the stadium and at the White House. But his focus on the needy, the vulnerable, was extraordinary. And we were able to pick up on that. And I think there's absolutely no doubt in my mind that the church is the number one provider of these kinds of services, that we are certainly regularly looking for opportunities to expand them intelligently. And our housing program, for example, we now have a very aggressive housing program for the working poor and the homeless. We've gone from 30 people under roof several years ago to 160 people under roof now, and we'll have 300 people under roof by the end of this year. So there are incremental programs that we are adding that are focused clearly on the less fortunate.
That was Al Barber, President of Catholic Charities in Fairfield County, Connecticut. And that's all from us here at the English Programme for today, but we'll be back on the air at the same time tomorrow, so be sure to join us then if you can. And don't forget, you can always find our programmes on the internet at www.vaticanradio. Laudato Jesus Christus.